knights and fair maidens, adventure and romance, triumph and tragedy, chivalry and villainy. These are the Middle Ages, and this is your gateway to the medieval world. I invite you to step back in time and experience All Things Medieval, the podcast dedicated to bringing you knowledge, tales, and insights into the Middle Ages of the past, the present, and of the future.
And so then I say, well, that might be all well and good, but I've got an axe on the saddle outside.
What?
A what?
It's a podcast.
Podcast. Oh, crap. I'll get back to you guys. See you later.
And welcome, lords and ladies, to this episode 11 of the All Things Medieval podcast. I've just been out checking the war horses in the stable, so apologies if I've run a little bit late. I've been really busy. No, really, I have. Actually, honestly, I've been really busy. If you visit the forums at least as regularly as I do, then you're probably aware that I've had quite a few jobs on. I've been really, really busy doing some stuff with Warner Brothers Studios, being mucked around as these sort of movie companies are notoriously known to do. It's been fun. Admittedly, it wasn't everything that I hoped for it to be. There were a lot of changes at the last minute and then halfway through. And in the end, there was a lot of stuff which I actually wasn't required for. But they still keep you hanging about. At least I get paid. That's the most important thing, I suppose. What else have I been doing? Looking after my poor old war horse, Casper. Now, as I mentioned, I was just down at the stables checking the horses. Poor old Casper, he's probably about 34 years old, they estimate him to be, in the early to mid-30s. So we've sort of got it pegged down about 34. And if you know anything about horses, that's really, really old for a horse. And the poor old fella, he's been losing condition, and it's not good. They possibly think he might have cancer, but it's really, really hard to tell. So I've had to dose him up on different antibiotics and penicillin, that's right. And I've had to give the poor old fella his needles and such. So that's been keeping me pretty busy as well. Also, not to mention doing stuff normally outside of those two odd jobs, I guess you'd call them. I've just been keeping up with my museum work and different things like that. So really, really busy. I'm hoping that sometime in the near future, when I say near future, you've got to take that with a pinch of salt, listeners. But I'm hoping that maybe halfway through the year, I'll be able to do a weekly show. At very worst case scenario, I reckon this time next year, it will be weekly. So, yeah, I can hear you all laughing and scoffing and mocking. But I assure you, when I say that I'm going to do something, sometimes I actually do it. So, just keep an eye out for that one. What else has been going on? Oh, we've got a winner for the DVD, which was Sarge. Congratulations, Sarge. I'm not too sure which part of the country you're going to be in at this present point in time when you're listening to it. So when you get a chance, send me an email or pop on the forums or a private message on the forums or something. Get in touch with me and let me know where I can post this DVD, American Jouster, off to you. Congratulations. What else? I'm in the market for a new horse. I do have another horse, but he's a little bit, shall we say, high-spirited, and he's got a bit of a horrible gait, I suppose. Now, he's a beautiful horse, don't get me wrong, but I don't think he's really cut out for the canter, and I've had a few people tell me that, including Luke Binks, who I missed on his visit here to Australia for his Australian night school. Don't even know if it was a success or not. I've just been too busy. I've hardly had time to keep up with anything, really. One thing I did have time for, though, was Bob Chiron's Fiore seminar here in Brisbane, held hosted by Kit Houston and the Fiore Medieval School of Defence down there in Melbourne. And it was awesome. It was great. Anyone who's interested in swordsmanship, medieval swordsmanship, that is, and if you get a chance to meet Bob Chiron and his lovely wife, or if you can even just sort of hop on the internet and find some stuff, or it's really worthwhile. It's worth your while to to attend one of those seminars. So a big thanks to Kit for bringing him over to Australia, and hope to see him here again next year.
Bringing you the latest happenings from across the kingdom, here comes the All Things Medieval Herald in the Herald's Call.
Thank you, Herald. Wow, you're early. Oh, yes, I'm late. Okay, never mind. We've got a lot of news to get through this time around, so we'll get straight into it. Before we do, though, I'd like to give a special thanks to Jim Mowat from HistoryZine.com for all of his support and all of his encouragement. I meant to mention him last episode in that big long list of thank yous, and I forgot all about poor old Jim. So apologies, Jim. You've been a great help, and I'll be in touch with you again soon to get some more advice, if you're still willing to give it, that is. So, straight into the news, like I said, we've got a lot, and you'll see a bit of a reoccurring theme throughout this. I might mention as well, some of these news stories are probably old hat to some listeners. You've probably already heard about such things that I'm about to report on, but nevertheless, we'll get into it anyway. First of all, we'll start with something a bit fun, shall we? If you head over to www.freecreditreportband.com and check out the little video clip there, that's a whole lot of fun. That's some guys dressed up in some medieval clothing and singing a bit of a song, doing a little bit of a jingle for freecreditreport.com. And it's quite witty, pretty funny. I got a giggle out of it, so yeah, go and check that out. Next of all, this is old news, but the SCA actually have a podcast, or there's a couple of guys from the SCA who are doing a podcast. You can find it at www.lionsroad.org, and it started last year, and it's a weekly show. Wow, fancy that. People doing weekly shows. Wow, that's amazing. The mind boggles. You might have to be in the SCA to fully appreciate that show, but it's still a lot of fun. It's well put together. There's some good moments in there that'll make you have a laugh, some informative moments. But really, I think you do need to be in the SCA to get the absolute most out of it, to understand the some of the jargon and some of the subject matter. But nevertheless, go and check it out because it is a lot of fun. Okay, next on, we have an article in the UK Guardian newspaper all about dodgy Viking swords. Now, what they're saying is that there were some swords that have been discovered, and upon testing them, they've worked out that these swords were rather brittle, but they were sold as being fairly well-known blades. They were made by, I think it was a, yeah, here we go, the Ulberths. And they used the best northern metalworking techniques around. They had a fairly good name, but there were some people that were making some dodgy, some replicas. Now we're not going to point any fingers over towards Pakistan or India, okay, but you can imagine it's something fairly similar to that. Now, what they're saying is that they didn't really know about these dodgy swords until they got into battle. So basically, it's almost like they thought they were going into the race with a Ferrari, and it turns out just to be a hotted up VW or something like that. Well, maybe not, but you know, it's something similar to that. So they finally, once in the heat of battle, they found out and these swords break. This is what they're assuming. Okay, now we'd have to apply some logic and say that any sword in the heat of battle has a likelihood of breaking, no matter how well made that it is. But perhaps these ones, perhaps what they're saying is that these ones were more likely to break in battle, leaving a Viking to cry out in horror, fiddle-dee-dee, or some other probably appropriate Norse exclamation, I'd say. Now, they're saying that they did some tests as well, that they found that these swords had a phenomenally high carbon content, three times that... Oh, sorry, the genuine ones had a high carbon content, three times that of the fakes, and half of that, again, of modern carbon steel. Now, they're saying that they hardened the swords by plunging the red-hot blade into cold water and enabled them to give a keen edge but made it fatally brittle. Okay, so they're saying that these swords were made in such a way and stamped with this this exclusive swordsmith stamp, or basically, you know, put out under their name. And so a lot of Vikings were ripped off. So, yeah, that's interesting to hear about and report on. I'm starting to ramble a little bit, so... And what's our next story? Ah, yes, rise, Sir Terry Pratchett. That's right, Terry Pratchett is now Sir Terry Pratchett. He was knighted, actually, I think he was knighted maybe last year, or maybe it was January or February, but some time has elapsed, since I first found out about this. Now, some of you might be wondering, who's Terry Pratchett then? He's a fairly well-known British author, author of the Discworld series, among other things. That's the one he's most famous for. And it's nice to see someone aside from a sports star or a musician become knighted. Oh, well, I'm sure that there's, you know, probably lots of them that aren't sports stars and musicians. But yeah, good on you, Sir Terry. And yeah, good job. Keep up the good work. So the Luttrell Salter DVD, I reported on that last episode. And I think I mentioned all the profits from the sales of this DVD go towards making the Luttrell Salter Part 2, which is based on the life of Sir Geoffrey Luttrell and his household. Now, I got my copy of the Luttrell Salter not long after episode 10 dropped. I think it was a couple of days afterwards, and I watched it, and I've watched it again, and I've watched it again. Now, you might think, well, you've been busy, how have you got time to watch this? It only goes for 15 minutes, and I actually only just the other day had time to view the special features, and it's pretty cool. I'd urge you to check it out. It's a lot of fun, and it's not very expensive, and profits go to a good cause. So have a look at this Luttrell Salter DVD. Get one now. Some media website of the name I cannot remember at the moment reports galloping into theatres, Nicolas Cage will once again work with Gone in 60 Seconds director Dominic Cena in Relativity Media's season of The Witch. The story follows a 14th century knight who must escort on horseback a girl suspected of being the witch behind the Black Plague to a distant monastery. The action-loving Cena was presumably hesitant until Cage convinced him that he could put in some bitchin' horse chases. Also stars Ron Perlman, and it's set for a 2010 release date. Some people may have heard this already, that Ridley Scott is going to make Robin Hood. Now, Mr. Ridley Scott reports that it's been done many, many times in the past, but no one's done it right. And this time he's going to do it right, and who better to do it right than Russell Crowe? That's right, Russell Crowe's going to be playing the world-famous rob from the rich, give to the poor kind of bandit. And it's also said that he's going to be playing another role, in which I think he's the sheriff. Someone may have to correct me on that. But yeah, he's going to be playing two roles, so that should be interesting. And, yeah, I'm not too sure exactly why Ridley Scott's chose to make it that way, and I'm not too sure if he's going to get it right. He's hoping that he does. But, yeah, it'll be interesting nonetheless. I'm looking forward to it. And filmmaker Martin Scorsese has optioned the book The Last Duel as a future motion picture that he will produce and possibly direct. Now, I reported on this, I think, way back. It might have been episode 1 or 2. But now, early casting rumours claim that even though the two men were in their early 50s at the time of the duel, that is, the two actual historical men that performed the duel, the people who are being considered to play the parts, one of Jean de Carrouge is Matt Damon, and Leonardo DiCaprio is being considered to play against Matt Damon as Jacques Legris, the alleged rapist. So, that'll be interesting, and I don't know why filmmakers have to always go for, now there's some really great American actors, but why can't we go for some French actors, or at least someone with a who can speak in a French accent if they're going to be playing these roles? Like, why do we always have to make it so commercial, just so played and boring? Let's spice it up a bit and make it the way that it should have been made. You know what? I'd love someone in France to make a movie about this. That would be absolutely awesome. So, Can anyone fill me in on details? Maybe a movie has been made in the past, but that'd be a lot of fun, I think. Nevertheless, there are three movies that I am looking forward to seeing. Whether they're good, bad, or whatever, I'm pretty easy pleased when it comes to movies, so I am looking forward to them. Okay, next of all, Dante's Inferno is coming to Xbox 360. That's right, Dante's Inferno is based on the medieval epic poem The Divine Comedy by Dante Alighieri. The dark fiction gave birth to the Tuscan Italian dialect and is widely considered the work that has defined the Western world's contemporary conception of hell and purgatory. The poem tells the tale of Dante, who journeys through the twisted, menacing nine circles of hell in pursuit of his beloved Beatrice. Dante's tortured and tormented world is an ideal setting for this third-person action and adventure of a video game, Dante's Inferno. Written in the 14th century, the Divine Comedy was published and read aloud in Italian, thereby making the poem accessible to the mass public. The poem delivers a striking and allegorical vision of the Christian afterlife and the punishments of hell. In part one, known as Dante's Inferno, Dante traverses all nine circles of hell: limbo, lust, gluttony, greed, wrath, heresy, violence, fraud, and treachery. So we can probably expect to see a lot of that in the game. And finally, I'm going to show a little bit of bias in musical tastes here and report on something for all you headbangers out there. It has been out for a little while, but Cradle of Filth's Godspeed on the Devil's Thunder, The Life and Crimes of Gilles de Rais, is based on the life of the infamous 15th century French nobleman who fought alongside Joan of Arc and accumulated great wealth before becoming a serial killer, sexual deviant, and alleged Satanist. He's also more commonly known as Bluebeard, so if you're into horror stories and if you're into heavy metal, then that CD is a definite must for you. Also, while we're on the subject of heavy metal and medieval stuff, Amon Amarth have released a new album called Twilight of the Thunder God. If you're into Viking metal, then you can't go past that. And finally, Creator have brought out a new album called Hordes of Chaos, and they have an awesome video clip for the title track of the song, Hordes of Chaos, which if you're into Conan the Barbarian and Frank Frazetta artwork, you've really got to check that out. So apologies to anyone who's not really into heavy metal, and maybe I should look at some other styles of music to report upon. So if you've got something that you think may be of some interest to this subject matter, then get in touch with us and we'll put it on the show.
Come hither, lords and ladies, gather round and lend an ear while I tell you about fairs, tournaments and events coming soon to these fair lands.
So I hope you haven't been relying too much on this show to inform you of events that's going on in your area or in areas you may be travelling through. But nevertheless, we'll still forge on with the events section. We'll get straight into it. And we'll start with Beads World on the 17th of May from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. is a free medieval fair. That's right, I said free. It's got breathtaking swordplay, colourful living history encampment, stunning falconry displays. That must be really cool. In Australia, it's really hard for us to have falconry displays because of wildlife laws, flora and fauna laws. But that must be really cool to watch. I know there's someone down south that does it, but apparently they cost an arm and a leg. But I digress. So it has stunning falconry displays and mischievous medieval minstrels, and it just forms part of the fun-filled program of activities. There's also free admission to the museum on the day and the recreated Anglo-Saxon farm, which sounds really cool. For more information, visit www.beadsworld.co.uk and check out the video podcast tour of the farm while you're there. Galway Early Music promotes the performance of medieval, Renaissance and Baroque music in Galway City and County in Ireland. The Galway Early Music Festival runs annually in May and features concerts by top international performers, workshops, schools, events and music and theatre in the Galway City Museum and in the street. The festival has a unique, relaxed and friendly atmosphere and highlights the medieval town of Galway and the artistic cultural richness of the area. For more information on that, check out galwayearlymusic.com. I don't have any dates down for that. I won't take the time to look it up now, but I'm pretty sure that was in May too. But head over to the website www.galwayearlymusic.com if you'd like more information. I'd like some more information, by the way, on some events that take place in Ireland and in Scotland, for that matter. There must be some events that take place over there. So if there's anyone listening who's familiar with that, particularly if you're from Scotland or Ireland, then get in touch with us here at podcast@sirjustin.com and let us know. Back by popular demand on the 23rd and 24th of May is My Lords, My Ladies Medieval Fair in Blacktown, New South Wales, Australia, which is down near Sydney, or part of Sydney. Get set to step back in time to the dark world of our medieval ancestors, featuring colourful pavilions, jousting competitions, combat displays, archery and period jewellery making. Featuring regal pageantry from the past, kings and queens, lords and ladies and knights in full armour. Visitors will experience the excitement of living history at its best. Bring a picnic or purchase your lunch and enjoy a great family day out from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Nurrungingi Reserve, Knox Road, Doonside. So that's the 23rd and 24th of May. What else do we have? We have the Escondido Renaissance Fair, April 25th and 26th, and the 2nd of 3rd in May. So you've probably missed the first weekend of that particular event, but the following weekend, on the 2nd and 3rd of May 2009, we'll still be on, and that's at Felicita Park, Escondido, California, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. That's each day, that's Saturday and Sunday. And it's also on October 31st, November 1st and November 7th to 8th. That's 2009, of course, and it's complete with markets, minstrels, mass battles. I wonder if that's battles in the church, mass battles. Get it? Okay, never mind. And all in a park of oak trees. That sounds really, really cool. Find out more information at www.goldcoastfestivals.com. Escondido Erin Info. Yes, I'll put the link in the notes, okay? So if you'd like to find out about other medieval or Renaissance fairs in the USA, Canada, and some other parts of the world, including Australia, I urge you to pick up a copy of Renaissance Magazine. And if you're looking for events in the UK and Europe, grab a copy of Skirmish Magazine. Or alternatively, you can check out their websites at www.renaissancemagazine.com and www.skirmishmagazine.com, respectively. I'll put those links in the notes, as I will with all of the other web links that I've mentioned in the show thus far, and any more that I'll mention as well, for that matter. Now, I have a question for all you lords and ladies. Do you like this segment of the show? Is it of any use to you, and would you like to see it continued or replaced with something else? I do know a couple of people have learned about events in their local area thanks to this section, so I would like to keep it going in some format, but perhaps its place is in the forums and not on the show. I would like to hear what you think. Quite possibly this area is an area which eventually I could get some form of sponsorship in the way of giveaways, tickets or goods which I can give away as prizes. As well, so I'm not too sure whether to get rid of it or leave it here, but I'm happy to hear what you'd think, and you can email me your suggestions, opinions, thoughts and ideas at podcast@sirjustin.com, and if you do, you'll actually go into a prize draw as well. So I might announce that at the end of the show, only because I can't remember what I've got. I've got a couple of goodies that I can give away, so I'll have a look, I'll take a break and I'll have a look and get back to you at the end of the show on that one. But that's enough rambling from me. There's enough rambling from me after episode one, I think, but never mind. We'll get on with the main feature.
And now it's time for the All Things Medieval Podcast main feature. Listen to discourse and interviews where we talk about a featured topic or chat with a special guest.
Travel in the Middle Ages. Was it really all that bad? Well, we won't find out this episode, for I'm yet to finish writing the article. So instead, what we'll be looking at today is something a little bit less research intensive, and we'll be addressing a popular topic among fans of the Middle Ages, which is medieval food, beverage and cooking. Of course, it wouldn't be complete if I didn't include some information about etiquette, and of course, some recipes and advice on how to create your own dishes and beverages. Books that I will reference during this feature, I'll get this out of the way right now, and these will be in the show notes as well, so don't stress out too much if you don't catch the title or the author's name. You can always head on over to the forums as well to get some more information, but anyway, the books that I'll reference are The Medieval Cookbook by Maggie Black, Fabulous Feasts by Madeline Pellner Cosman, Cooking and Eating by Katie Stewart, Feast by Roy Strong, Charlemagne's Tablecloth by Nicola Fletcher, and Food and Feast in Medieval England by Peter Hammond. This topic has an endless list of resources, and you could spend hundreds of hours in its study, if not more. So, as per the style of this show, I'll do my very best to condense it and just hit on some of the highlights or some of the primary facts and address some common myths, of which there seem to be plenty in this field. So we might start off first and foremost with what was it that they ate in the Middle Ages? And within that question also lies our very first myth, and that's in regards to the common folk. We often believe that the common folk had it pretty tough in terms of what they had to eat, that what they were eating was fairly unnutritious, unappetizing, and in some cases unhygienic. But we know that not to be the case. Food in the Middle Ages, as with many other things in this day and age, were not so different from food today. People ate pretty much the same sort of thing. Meat, such as beef, pork and lamb, or mutton. They ate fruit and vegetables, grain prepared in various ways, such as bread and ale, and those who could afford it drank wine. Their diet wasn't as restricted as we think it was, and the variety of foodstuffs that they had available, especially to those with the means to buy it, was very, very diverse. A lot of the food to Western Europe was imported. A lot of it was grown locally, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. But spices were easily available, and some of them came from as far away as the Middle East and China. And dried fruit, for example, such as the raisins of Corinth, were imported from the Eastern Mediterranean. There were sweet wines, which came from the same sort of area, and ordinary wines from all of the wine-growing regions of Europe. Exotic fruits, such as oranges, lemons, and pomegranates, were imported, and fish was a big staple of their diet as well, which came as far afield as Iceland. A lot of it salted, some of it fresh. A lot of it was also farmed locally. That's right, they had fish farms. They had ponds, which they would they'd more or less divert these streams into man-made ponds and pools, and there they would they would farm and harvest fish, especially in monasteries. Monasteries were very famous for doing that kind of thing. Food in the Middle Ages was also a bit spicier than you'd find, what is desirable in this day and age. So they were quite fond of the spicy flavour. A lot of people say it's because that they were hiding the taste of off meat, but that's not the case whatsoever. Spices were something which were... they were a commodity, and they quite enjoyed their spices, as much as, probably more so than we do today. Medieval food, in fact, is not entirely dissimilar to Middle Eastern food today. So Turkish food, Lebanese food, was all very similar to the medieval dishes. And even if you have a go at some of these recipes, which I'll give to you later on in the show, if you have had Middle Eastern food before, you'll actually see some similarities, such as the way they used to colour their food and things like that to dress it up and make it look a little more attractive, I guess. Okay, something else they enjoyed a lot in the Middle Ages were broth and soup-like dishes. So they were very, very popular because they were easy to make, and they were very nutritious as well, and they were fairly inexpensive. The types of crops that were planted were grain of several kinds, such as wheat, rye, barley and oats, the most common, though peas and beans were also grown. Wheat was probably the most common crop in the Middle Ages, and they used it to form two solid staples of anyone's diet, whether you were man, woman, boy, child, peasant or noble, and that was bread and ale. Now, we should talk a little bit about the ale, I suppose. Ales came in different strengths. So you had the first wash, which was always the strongest strength ale, probably equivalent to a modern-day English ale. Then you had a second wash ale, which was a little bit less in strength. You had a third wash, which was like a light to mid-strength, and a fourth and fifth wash, which was commonly called a breakfast ale or a child's ale. Now, the reason they call those breakfast ales or child's ales are fairly self-explanatory. So they'd drink this at breakfast, and they'd also feed it to children. Now, it was very low in alcohol content, but high in nutrition. So you had a lot of the nutrition from the wheat, the malt, and what have you, that actually, and it, because it was water-based as well, it was also it was good for you. So it wasn't because they were great big boozers, and anyone that's out there that already starts the morning with a heavy dose of ale, try to remember, just water it down. It worked for those in the Middle Ages. It could work for you today. So, and I'm not actually suggesting that anyone should have a beer for breakfast. This is only for those who already are having a beer or two for breakfast. Try watering it down a fair bit, okay? I should also mention another myth that we hear a lot is that water in the Middle Ages was unfit to drink. Now, and they say that accounts for the amount of ale that was consumed in the Middle Ages, and that is a common myth. to make ale, you actually had to have pretty pure water. I mean, we're talking the purest water you could find, so much so that there were actual springs, wells, and water supplies, especially in the City of London in the Middle Ages, which were designated for such supplies because that water was the purest. You weren't allowed to take that water, you weren't allowed to wash in it, you weren't allowed to throw things in it, things like that. And you could actually be fined fairly heavily or imprisoned depending on the nature of the offence and if you were a repeat offender or not. So it was fairly important. As we can see in history, it states that the cities did have to have fresh, pure water supplies at all times. Now, that could vary, of course, but the fact that the water was available is a fairly well-known fact these days, and that it was unfit to drink is actually pure myth. Okay, I'm sure there was water that was unfit to drink, especially in the cities, but it's just like a country stream today, or perhaps a spring, something like that. You could drink straight out of that, perhaps as long as the mineral content's not going to make you terribly ill or things like that. But in the Middle Ages, they knew what they were doing, and water was consumed on a fairly regular basis. Now, we mentioned that we give our children ale, because we don't these days, do we, listeners? But back then, they gave their children ale. Now, you might wonder, why didn't they give them milk? Now, of course, they did give them milk when they were infants. They gave them breast milk. But as they got older, not very many people actually drank milk. Milk was, they drank curds, which was sort of the, I think they make the milk sort of go a little bit off, so they would drink that as a beverage. But milk itself was used primarily in cooking, and very seldom do we actually see it, or does it seem to appear as a beverage all of its own. Another beverage which was very popular in the Middle Ages was wine. Now, in the Middle Ages, wine, we classify fortified spirits. We also classify liqueurs into the wine category of the Middle Ages. So a lot of your fruit liqueurs, like schnapps and things like that, they actually called them brandy wine. And we also see a lot of ports, a lot of different sort of dessert wines, which all fall into the same category as wine, as we call it today. So it was consumed a lot by those who could afford it. Another beverage which was very popular, of course, was mead. Everyone's probably heard of mead, and we'll have a recipe for mead at the end of this episode, and it's quite a nice recipe as well. Mead, for anyone who didn't know, was made from honey. It wasn't made from grape or grain. It was simply water with honey and with a bunch of spices thrown in, depending on the taste of the imbiber. You could also use fruit in mead as well, so you could have a peach mead, an apple mead, different things like that. Oh, and I should mention that in England, particularly in the West Countries, or the West Counties of England, cider was very, very popular as well. Now, I mentioned about the meat that they ate. What I didn't mention about was poultry. They used to eat all manner of poultry, from chicken to geese, though the noble folk thought that chicken and geese was a little bit beneath them, but you could spice it up using some expensive spices and side dishes to turn it into a dish that was adequately suited a man or lady of proper rank and title. So other poultry that they ate ranged from pigeon. Pigeon was very, very popular. Pheasant, that's pheasant, not peasant. What else did they eat? This one might be a bit of a turn-off for some people, but they ate peacock as well. So that was a very popular dish. And seafood. Now, seafood was very, very popular throughout the Middle Ages. We're talking oysters, mussels, shrimp, the saltfish, as well as freshwater fish. Very, very popular. And, of course, because on many... They actually had three fasting days a week. That's every week. It wasn't just Good Friday as we have today, for those who still follow those practices. But in the Middle Ages, there were actually 3 days in the week in which they were not allowed to eat anything but fish. And also during the period of Lent, they only had one meal during the day, and that was normally fish or fish broth as well, or a fish soup. So fish was very, very popular. Oh, something I forgot, which is important, the fish farms made me think of it, were the deer parks. They ate a lot of venison. We actually see the nobles ate more venison than they ate any other meat. But we also see that with the clergy, but we can sort of classify the clergy as part of the nobility, or at least on equal footing with the nobles. So venison was a very, very popular meat. And we all, to the extent that we have deer parks where they would farm deers and they would cull deers or harvest deers for the dinner table so that they had venison all year round. And some of the other things they ate, of course, were things like nuts, eggs, cheeses, a lot of different varieties of cheeses, from goat to sheep to cow, things like that. What else did they have? They had they ate a lot of game meat, as I mentioned, but I forgot to mention hares, rabbits, and quail was also on the menu. Lots and lots of different things like that. Now, the form that this food would take, they wouldn't just take it and boil it or roast it. They'd actually turn it into some fairly clever things. So they actually had sausages back then. They would make a lot of pies, as mentioned, a lot of soups or broth, sometimes some stews. Those stews were considered somewhat of more of a commoner's dish, or perhaps a dish that was used whilst out on campaign or something like that. Some other foods which were, of course, around in the Middle Ages were eggs. That's eggs of almost any kind, from any kind of bird. Also, hares and rabbits were a staple, especially among the common folk. And also, cheese was very, very popular. Now, this food wasn't presented as just its raw form. There you go, slap it on the table, ready to eat. Of course, they had recipes, and they made these marvellous works of culinary art, I guess you could call it, especially in the higher levels of society. So where did they get their food in the Middle Ages? In the Middle Ages, there were no grocers or supermarkets as we know them today. The closest thing to a supermarket were the markets, which were a gathering of stalls and vendors who sold a variety of foods. These markets were most common, as you may assume, in towns and cities, though villages or shires and counties also held markets on a weekly or monthly basis. In urban areas, however, markets were an occurrence that took place 6 out of 7 days a week. Of course, most food in the Middle Ages was grown and farmed locally. There were other foods such as oranges, olives, Asian spices, and a variety of other sort of things that were available in Western Europe after being imported from the southeastern Mediterranean regions, the Middle East, and, believe it or not, from China. It's not until the 16th century and beyond that foods such as tomatoes and potatoes start to be imported from the New World. Meat was butchered locally as they needed it and sold fresh. Any surplus meat would be preserved, salted, or turned into pies and the like to ensure that little was wasted. Fat was considerably healthy to people of the Middle Ages and probably was due to their lack of saturated fat such as we have an abundance of today. And as a result, a good portion of meat typically had fat on the edges. This fat was usually not eaten right off the meat, but cut off and used in other recipes. In fact, a law was passed in medieval London at one point in time that prohibited the sale of meat without a quantified portion of fat. Can you believe that? Imagine going to a supermarket today and asking for the fattiest bit of steak or taking it back saying, this steak doesn't have enough fat on it. They'd look at you a little bit strangely. It's very different to today. Butchers back then, to qualify some leaner cuts of meat, would actually sew fat onto the cuts if there was not enough already on it. We're not entirely sure if this applied to all meats or just to some of the expected fatty meats such as pork, bacon, lamb or beef. Other food that was imported was fish. Even though most had access to fish at any given time, certain varieties of fish and seafood would be imported, especially Scandinavian styles of preserved fish. Herrings, for example, were imported into the rest of Europe by the barrel loads. In cities, shops could make a prosperous trade in the sale of foodstuffs. As a result, butchers, bakers, pepperers, which were spice sellers, and I might just digress a moment. I know we have a listener who's actually a pepperer over there in England, and he actually informed me that the pepperers would actually make up certain mixes of spices, and they'd keep them, it'd be a fairly secretive kind of a mix, or a well-guarded mix, which if it became popular, people would continually go back to that same pepperer to buy his special spice mix. So that's an interesting bit of information there. So, as I was saying, that there was a prosperous trade in the sale of foodstuffs, and as a result, butchers, bakers, pepperers, pie makers, cheese makers, and all manner of specialty culinary shops were able to be found. Usually to make life easier and to ensure fair trade for the consumer and among the appropriate governing guilds and their members, whole streets were dedicated to one particular type of shop. For example, a heavy concentration of bakers could be found in one street and, by chance, would usually be named Baker Street or something along those lines because of the trade found within that particular street. And as you can tell, I was being facetious, it wasn't by chance at all. Street vendors also patrolled the districts, calling out to the crowds the qualities and prices of the goods they were selling, as well as a brief description, I suppose. This applied not only to pre-made or cut goods, but to livestock and grown foodstuffs as well. Most often, these peddlers had some sort of deal or license, or perhaps were a part of another shop, and they were permitted by their respective guilds to travel out to sell their products to those incapable of getting out and about. Woe to the peddler or shop who was not a member of their respective trade guild. The trade guilds actually held a lot of economic power in the Middle Ages, and if you weren't a part of it, they could shut you down or they could make life fairly miserable and very expensive for you if you didn't join their guild. What else do we have? Many city-dwelling folk had their own herb gardens for the purpose of growing medicinal and culinary herbs, but this, of course, was limited to the most basic of types. These gardens range from simple planter box-style gardens for the common folk, right up to elaborate gardens of produce and exotic spices and herbs for the richer folk, and also for the churches and monasteries. Monasteries, by the way, we should mention a little bit about monasteries. They were usually always self-sufficient in every area they were to be found, and they were able to sell a lot of excess food to the general public without guild restrictions. Of course, most monasteries were found in rural areas, so they didn't come across the urban economic structure as much, though they would go to town sometimes, or perhaps someone would travel to a monastery to buy surplus goods to bring back to a more urban area or even to a village to sell to the people. Now, these monasteries were self-sufficient in pretty much every foodstuff that we've mentioned. They grew it, they made it, or they farmed it. So everything from fresh meat to fish to deer to all sorts of different stuff, they were pretty much self-sufficient. I should also mention that monasteries also offered services much like an inn. They would be free from vice and free from sin as far as the medieval mind was concerned, as opposed to the inns, which were fairly secular and endorsed all sorts of vices and all sorts of sinful activities in said inns. So the monasteries were available to actually stay at, and a lot of people stayed at such places, not just for the fact that they could avoid sin, but for the fact that monasteries normally had some pretty good chow and fairly inexpensive as compared to other places. Taverns cooked meals and baked bread and, of course, made ale and provided other beverages, and there were many taverns in urban areas, as you can imagine. These were populated by travellers and by those who had not the time or inclination to cook for themselves, but taverns sold food for the takeaway consumption of locals as well. Taverns were less frequent outside of the urban areas and replaced by inns, which we mentioned not so long ago, that served pretty much the same purpose, though were more like stopover points than a place just to eat and drink and socialise. One of the myths we hear about food in the Middle Ages is that it was either very bland or it was very rich. But as you can imagine, that ran the scale pretty much as it does today. I mean, you can go into a restaurant today and order a meal or fast food and find it's very bland, and the opposite occurs as well. You can find something that's very rich and almost unpalatable. And that's not necessarily defined to any one single class or price dynamic we're looking, or price demographic. So you're looking at today, if you go into it, you can go to a fairly pricey place and buy crap food, but you can also go into a pricey place and buy some very tasty food. The same rang true in the Middle Ages. So was the food healthy? Was it tasty? We can imagine that. Of course, we'll never really know for certain, but we can imagine that people, they haven't really changed over thousands of years. You can imagine that they'd be eating food which they enjoy. They wouldn't be eating food which is absolutely terrible. And in terms of whether or not it was healthy, well, for the lower class people, it probably wasn't as healthy as say, what the nobility were having, but the nobility also had the opportunity to overindulge and thus ruin their health or jeopardize their health, much in the same way that we can today. So in terms of healthiness, if it's comparable to the food we have today as, the readily available food that we have today, then the food in the Middle Ages was actually much more healthier. It was less processed, there were less saturated fats, there were more complex carbohydrates in their meals than what we have today. So overall, they did have more of a healthy eating lifestyle on the average to what we have today. The nobles, on the other hand, they had access to a lot of high-protein game meats, which were low in saturated fats. It had a lot of omega fats in it, the fish and different foodstuffs like that, eggs as well, cheese, which wasn't as processed as we have it today. So on the overall, they too had a much healthier eating lifestyle than what most of us have today as well. Compared to each other, the nobles certainly had a lot more range in nutrition. So it was far more likely that they'd be healthier, stronger, which was more suited to their physical appearance. That said, though, the common folk weren't. You often see in the movies they're eating gruel or some sort of horrid-looking mush. It's not quite as bad as that. Okay, the food that they did have was fairly healthy. It was very palatable, we can imagine, especially looking at some of the recipes that we have today. And it's also visually appealing as well, is what I'm trying to say. I got lost in my train of thought there, which is, well, that's pretty unusual. Doesn't happen often, does it, listener? Oh, I could only have one listener, I suppose. I shouldn't be so optimistic. No, I know there's a few more than just one out there. So what else do we have? I think we're running a bit short on this. I know I said I'd have some recipes, but what I might do is I'll break this up into a two-part episode. Now, don't fret. I know many listeners out there, or perhaps that one listener, is bemoaning, oh no, it'll take another 6 months before we hear part two. Fear not, loyal listeners, I'll make sure that the next episode, because I've pretty much got all my notes ready, I'll make sure the next episode is hot on the heels of this one, and we'll get this resolved. In the next episode then, what we'll talk about, beverages in the Middle Ages, and then we'll have some recipes for food and for some beverages as well. So hopefully you'll join me there in episode number 12 of All Things Medieval. So that's it for the main feature. We'll move on to the next segment.
Let us venture forth, lords and ladies, into the busy marketplace. Wares of all kinds you will find here. Stick close, and I'll keep the cut purses and charlatans off your backs. I know of a merchant house just over here, where we can relax and take our time considering today's goods and services. Ah, here we are now. Let's go inside and lose this crowd, shall we?
Doesn't it seem like a long time since we've last ventured through the marketplace together? But here we are, and without any further ado, I might talk about some things which I don't really have anything scripted for this section, but I do have a couple of things I'd like to mention in regards to my own shopping experiences and different sort of news which I have in regards to products. So just recently, a friend of mine and myself put an order in with Albion Swords. Albion, if you remember right back from, I think it was episode 1 or possibly episode 2, or I think it was an episode somewhere between episode 1 and this episode, where I mentioned Albion Swords and that they were a fantastic sword to wield. Well, I encountered yet another one of the Albion Swords at the Bob Chiron seminar here in Brisbane, and after handling it, I got talking with my friend Aaron, and we decided, well, let's finally take the plunge and let's buy a couple of these swords for ourselves. Now, I've got to say that that dealing with Mike over at Albion Swords was an absolute pleasure. It was very prompt. It was he was very professional and very quick. The swords were manufactured so quickly that my head spun. I've never come across anyone before that does. That makes swords to order in such a short amount of time. I mean, I'm talking, I think I ordered it One day in around about a week, it may have been 10 days later, the swords were ready to go. Not all of them, but I mean, there were four in total. And over, I think it was over about two, possibly 3 weeks, all four swords were manufactured and arrived here in Australia and in our hot little hands. Now, I've got to say, these swords are absolutely beautiful. They've, I still stand firmly behind the fact that Albion swords make the best sword on the market today. It's really that good. People might balk a little bit when they look at the prices. That all depends on your taste. But I assure you that these swords are made to last. They're made as authentically as possible as the originals, and you cannot go wrong. I would much rather pay an extra couple of hundred dollars for a sword that I know is balanced correctly, that is made expertly and with a care and a passion behind the manufacture that I have in the same capacity in wielding the sword and learning about the sword. So really, I'd pay that extra couple of hundred dollars and be assured of a high quality product than save a couple of hundred dollars and have a sword that's crap. Okay, so really, if you're in the market for a new sword, check out albionswords.com. You cannot go wrong. Now, I have a listener uses the handle Stranger Tractor, and she actually sent me an email talking about Albion Swords and then realised that I'd mentioned about it in an earlier podcast. But she too, she's a native of Wisconsin, and that's where Albion Swords are situated, and she too had some wonderful things to say about Albion Swords, and just wanted to give them a plug because they were from her state. So thanks for that, Stranger Tractor, and thanks for mentioning them again. I'm not being paid to do this, by the way. I'm just endorsing a product which I firmly stand behind. There's no doubt in my mind that they're the best swords currently on the market that I've come across and that many others have come across as well. So while we're on the subject of craftsmen that are making high quality goods, all leather in New South Wales, where are they from? Can't remember it just off the top of my head. Balingan, I think, is where they're from in New South Wales. They do a range of medieval footwear, and this is high quality stuff. I mean, I've had a lot of shoes in my time, not as many shoes as I have had swords, but I've had a lot of medieval shoes in my time, and these shoes are by far the best. They're handcrafted, they're made from high quality leather, and again, these guys, they had the shoes made in around about 10 days. Maybe it was 2 weeks, I'm not too sure, but they had them made so quickly and shipped to me, and they were in my hot little hands, or on my hot little tootsies, in absolutely no time whatsoever. And I mean, great authentically made shoes, can't go wrong. And the price, I bought some 14th century style boots, modelled after a find in London, and they were made in, like I said, made in record amount of time, handmade, hand-stitched, and they were only $150 Australian, so for a pair of boots that are actually made to fit you specifically, custom fit to your foot, and they're not a generic boot, so you're not going to see 100 of them out there in the marketplace. Again, it's a worthwhile investment. Generally, you might pay about $100 for a pair of authentically made medieval reproduction shoes. I'm not sure how that terminology all fits together, but yeah, we'll just jam it in there for the moment. But you can pay about $100 for a generic pair, but again, if you want a quality product that's going to last and that's going to stand out and make you notable among your peers, then I'd suggest all leather shoes and boots. Get Dressed for Battle is a company from the UK who have they've currently gone global, so you can find their goods in many, many countries all around the world. They used to have a lot of Indian-made stuff. Now, as I've mentioned before, I'm not a huge fan of stuff that's made in Southeast Asia, and nothing against the craftsmen there, and I think I've mentioned that before, but it's just that the quality of the goods are not as good. They're very commercialised, they're pretty much, they get them out as quick as they can, and they don't seem to have as much of a passion or an interest in the goods as what we Western Europeans have. Now, I'm painting in very broad strokes here, so hopefully I haven't offended any listeners. If I have, just head over to the forums at sirjustin.com and let us know your thoughts and defend your stand, sir, madam. Defend your country and defend your craftsmen if you feel I've slighted them. So I'm digressing again. I'm picking a fight now, but that's nothing new. So Get Dressed for Battle used to have a lot of Indian-made stuff. Now, they had a craftsman, Martin Bevan from A Plaisance Armouries, who oversaw the manufacture of a lot of these goods. He did a lot of the prototypes. They sent them to India. He visited there, and various other things happened, and they got this great little range. It was a good range of goods, and it still is a good range. It's one of the better ranges out there, and they're highly recommended. But the reason I'm mentioning them, I think I've said all that before, so apologies if I'm boring you listeners. The reason I'm mentioning them is because they actually have some new suppliers, and it's a German company called Ulfendar. You know, I don't have the notes right in front of me, terribly unprofessional, but nevertheless, check out getdressedforbattle.com. I think it's gdfb.com.uk. Check that out and you'll actually see the news on there. Now, the goods that this company in Germany are actually producing are high quality, top stuff, really exciting stuff. And I mean, their prices are still possibly the lowest prices you'll find out there for quality goods. So Get Dressed for Battle, check them out. I'll put the, of course, I'll put the links to all of these places in the schnotes. And anyone that's in the market for goods, check these people out. Now, I might also mention my friends over at Historic Enterprises. That's Gwen, Jeff, and Luke over there, still doing their thing. Now, they're bringing out some wonderful products over there. They're still really sort of pumping out goods. But I was talking to Gwen not so long ago, and she mentioned that that everyone's really feeling the pinch because of these economic times. So I'm not too sure if you, listener, are feeling the pinch as well. But if you're not, if it happens that you're not and you're in the market for some medieval goods, head over to historicenterprises.com. Head over to any of these websites that I've mentioned, any of these suppliers, and help them out. Share some money about. I mean, all of these people, they have people working for them. Albion Swords have a staff of, I think, a couple of dozen. So, I mean, if you've got the means, if you can do it, then support some of your local artisans and craftsmen. And I mean local too, folks. I think that would be best for everyone involved. If you sort of look locally, that's a little hypocritical on my part since I just got some swords from the good old US of A. But, yeah, head out and do your bit to help make the economy a little bit stronger. Not that I think that's going to matter. Really, what I'm doing, I'm giving a plug to all of the artisans who deserve it, and really trying to hope that they can survive these hard times, because we don't want to see them go away, you know. So it's I'm not really plugging the economy. I'm just really hoping that some of my favourite suppliers stick around for a long, long time to come. They really deserve it. And so here we are, gentle listeners, at the end of another episode. As I mentioned, that main feature was cut short fairly abruptly, I think. And I'll have another episode out very, very soon, I promise you that, okay? So don't fret, it won't be as long, and I'm really, really hoping that I can soon turn this into a fortnightly, if not a weekly, occurrence. So just takes a little bit more time and a little bit more learning of this all of this audio stuff to get the hang of it. I think you may have noticed by now that some of my P's were percussive again, reminiscent of one of our earlier shows. I've got a new microphone, so it's going to take a little bit of mucking around with to try and get the settings right. So hopefully they haven't bothered you too much. Hopefully they haven't come through as much as I fear that they have. And your listening experience has been a pleasurable one. I think that's enough rambling from me, actually. I've been a little bit disjointed in my talking. I think it doesn't help that I record these episodes over the course of a few days instead of just sitting down and getting it done in one hit. So that too will hopefully change in the very near future. Before we go, I would like to respond to some listener feedback that I've had. Lady Brunhild has sent me an email, and apologies, my lady, I've not responded to it personally, but I thought that it might have been a good something to bring up here in this segment. Now, she has a question. She's Lady Brunhild has asked about the jousting way back when I did an interview with Mr. Luke Binks. She writes, I've seen this done in movies, and listening to the interview was great to hear about the horses and armour, etc., but I was curious if there were actually rules to jousting, or is it just a matter of running at the other person and trying to knock them off their horse? Also, when the guest was talking, he mentioned that he went to other countries to compete, and I just couldn't picture how he could travel with the lance, or whatever the jousting pole is called. I mean, it looks very long, and I'm guessing it doesn't retract. Does it come apart like a pool stick? She also goes on to say, sorry, I know this is probably a dumb question, but just wondering. Actually, Lady Brunhild, that's not a dumb question at all, and it's something that we really should have addressed, I suppose. Now, the rules of jousting varied from engagement to engagement in the Middle Ages. We see a lot of variation in the manuscripts of the actual rules and the tournaments, how they were run. This is dependent on culture. It's dependent on the style of tournament, and it's also dependent on the period as well. So a tournament from, say, a jousting tournament in particular from, say, the 12th century would look very different to one from the 15th century. So there was a lot of differing rules and a lot of differing styles and such. There's a southern Italian style of jousting where they actually joust. Normally when you're jousting across your body, so your opponent is on your left, you're holding the lance in your right hand, couching it in your right arm, and you're striking him across your own body. There's a southern Italian style of jousting where they actually jousted on the right, so their opponent was on their right side, which in combat was something which you would have encountered quite often on the battlefield, I'd imagine, but in an actual tournament was, I guess, from what we can understand from the evidence presented to us, was a fairly unorthodox way to joust. For all we know, though, it could have been just a common occurrence, as common as doing it in the orthodox manner. So there were indeed rules to jousting. Some jousts may say that there's three lances, three passes, others may say five, others may say seven. There may be blunts on the end of the lance, coronels. The lances may be designed to break easier, or the lances could be solid as well. Another variation is that they may joust with sharp lances as well, especially in deeds of arms. When they jousted during deeds of arms, they would more often than not use sharp lances. So rules would vary. Sometimes it was unhorsing meant that you lost your horse and lost your armour to an opponent. Sometimes it may have only been your horse, sometimes only your armour, or it could be nothing at all in terms of that. So it did vary a lot. It probably lends itself to being its own topic, and if I'm not careful, will turn into its own topic right here and right now. Now, this information is just information which I'm getting off the top of my head, so if I delve into it a little bit more and talk to some more professionals on the subject, possibly even get Mr. Luke Binks back, because he seems to have struck a bit of a chord with the listeners, and maybe we can get him back and we'll talk about this a little bit more at length. So now when he does indeed travel to other countries, he doesn't take the lances with him. Indeed, most of the time, and it was the same in the Middle Ages, if you went to a tournament, the tournament host was expected to supply those sort of things. Sometimes they'd even supply the horses as well. So obviously he doesn't travel with his horse, and he doesn't travel with his lances. He just takes his armour and takes his side weapons and whatever other things he may need on the trip with him. So yeah, it's now you asked, does it come apart like a pool stick? Well, actually, no, it doesn't. Pretty much all the lances are solid, except in some styles of jousting today that we have, we'll have a metal socket on the end with a piece of balsa, a 3-foot piece of balsa, to make the lance itself 12 feet. So you're looking at a 9-foot solid shaft or solid lance with a metal socket or aluminium socket on the end holding this 3 feet of balsa wood. Now, a lot of people think, oh, that's just balsa wood, that doesn't hurt at all. I can tell you that it's probably just as dangerous as using a solid lance, if not a little more dangerous, because what can happen, that socket can strike the balsa wood can break off at the socket, and when the socket strikes the shield or strikes the armour, it can have a tendency to slide up, and it can actually hit soft squishy bits and open people up. I know a couple of people that have had their chin open up because of wounds or because of the tips striking them. I even know of one gentleman who had some rather sensitive parts of his body almost torn completely off because of one of these. Actually, no, that was a solid lance. So, yeah, there you go. That's a fairly strong argument to say solid lances are actually... The more I think of it, the more I think it could have been a socketed lance. But anyway, I digress. It's dangerous, and either way that you do it, if you're not careful, and accidents can happen. But so they can come apart, but it still leaves you with a 9-foot-long solid lance, and obviously he wouldn't take that on the plane with him either. Okay, it might be a bit of an issue carrying it in your hand luggage, especially. So that's about it with listener feedback. Don't have much more to offer there. Now, I mentioned that we were going to have another competition this episode. And so I best mention the prizes, I suppose. I have a copy of A Moorland Hanging, a medieval West Country mystery by author Michael Jecks. Fantastic book. It's quite an entertaining read. I do have my own copy, so I actually haven't read this one. It's a brand new book, hasn't been read. And I also have a CD called Vous ou la Mort, and that's by Cantus Publishing. And it's 15th century love songs, courtly love songs, Flemish, I believe. Really great CD. That's also unopened and ready to go to a listener who's going to head over to the forums and make a post. So, as always, I'll take a list of all the people that have posted. The more you post, the more entries you'll have. So, the more you get over there and post something in, the more names you'll have in hat, and the greater chance you'll have at winning these wonderful, wonderful prizes. So, I think I mentioned it earlier in the podcast, but if you are a supplier of medieval goods, if you're an author or if you're a publisher or anything related to the genre, if you have something you'd like to donate to the prize pool here at All Things Medieval, do get in touch with me, okay? It doesn't necessarily have to come from me. It could even be a voucher or something like that. So if you have something and you're interested, you want to get involved, I mean, we have over 400 subscribers at the moment, and that's with the show as irregular as what it has been. So jump on board. Don't be the last to get on board in this, and maybe you can donate some prizes to our listeners and promote your goods or whatever it is, or services even. You can donate some services, perhaps. So yeah, do get in touch here with us at podcast@sirjustin.com, or head over onto the forums and see what you can offer up. Everything I've offered up as a prize so far has come from my own retail business, which is pretty slow at the moment because I've been too busy and re-envisioning exactly what it's doing. But I'm happy to support other companies and other businesses which are putting out high quality products and that are passionate about the Middle Ages as much as we all are here now. So, that is enough rambling for me. I think, hopefully, I'll have a little bit more sleep under my belt for the recording of the next episode. I'll be able to talk a little more coherently. And, hopefully it'll be a better episode all around. So, thanks, lords and ladies, for tuning in, listening to the show. Thanks for your continued support. Also, a quick shout-out to Mr. Scott Farrell from Chivalry Today podcast. Go over and check out his episodes. A lot of fun. A lot of great interviews. The last few episodes have been fantastic. So keep up the good work, Mr. Farrell. And we'll see all of you listeners. See all you listeners. Perhaps I'll hear from you listeners on the forums. And you'll hear from me next time on the All Things Medieval podcast. You can contact All Things Medieval podcast with your praise, criticism, suggestions, questions, and other feedback at podcast@sirjustin.com. Join in the forums over at sirjustin.com by clicking on the forums tab in the menu. Check out the goods for sale at www.themedievalemporium.com. Music is by Kevin MacLeod, used with permission at www.incompetech.com.